Welcome to another author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is delighted to have with us virtually four stellar historical mystery authors, Jenny Adams, Katie Teachen, Samantha Larson, and Ava January. Before we begin today, the Poison Pen does have copies of all of these authors' books, and we would be happy to hold one or more for you or put copies in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen Bookstore. I would like to welcome Jenny, Katie, Samantha, and Ava.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be here.
Me too.
We're delighted to have you with us. You've written such fabulous mysteries. My first question for each of you is, I'm always fascinated by how an author gets to where they're at as a published author. So why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about who you were before you became published? Why don't we start with Ava?
I am a mum of two boys still, pre-publication and post. I get rid of them. I was doing my, I'm not sure what you call it. We call it a bachelor of like a university degree. And I was doing my bachelor of creative arts, and I took an elective of creative writing. And I'm a passionate reader, like, you know, obsessive reader, have been my whole life. And my lecturer is an incredible published author. And she read my first assignment, and she said, "Oh, so you're a writer." And I said, "Oh, no, absolutely not. No, imagine." Huh? She said, "Oh, if you were to write a book, what would you write about?" And I said, "Oh, okay, well, it would be this or this or this or this." And she just kind of smiled and said, "Yeah, you're a writer. If you've got more than one idea and you can tell me, you're a writer." And she changed my assignment, and she said, "I just want you to now write what you've given me as the assignment. I want you to finish that off." And that became my first novel, The Lady Detective. Yeah.
Katie, what about you?
I have wanted to be a writer and a teacher for as long as I can remember. And this is now my 20th year as a public school teacher. Wow. So that has been a dream realized for a while now. And I just became a published author a couple of weeks ago with my debut mystery put out by Crooked Lane, which was so exciting for me. I have actually written about four novel length manuscripts before this. And those I think really helped me get to the point where I was able to develop this book. The first few, it was like, wow, look at me. I wrote something and it has a beginning and a middle and an end. And that's so exciting. But I didn't really have any knowledge about, you know, how to market a book or sell a book or get anyone to want to publish it or get an agent. So it was a really interesting journey to learn about all of that. And I found some great communities along the way. And I had a lot of advice and generous feedback from other published writers and folks in the publishing industry.
Samantha, who were you before you became a published author?
I was a librarian.
oh, cool. Yay, we love librarians.
I write Lady Librarian Mysteries. It feels, people listening can't hear it, see it, but my name is Samantha Hastings because I'm both Samantha Larson and Samantha Hastings. They're both my name, so it's actually Samantha Larson Hastings. But I published mysteries under Samantha Larson and then everything else under Samantha Hastings. So my first books to come out were in 2019 with Macmillan, By Will and Friends, some historical fiction with a little mystery. And I published with Harlequin quite a bit. And I love books with kissing. Murder and kissing, what more do you need, right?
That's true. One spectrum, two ends of the same spectrum, I guess, or something.
I think so.
Jenny, what about you? What can you tell us about yourself?
Well, I'm also a big fan of murder with my kissing books. But I am also a librarian. I am a school librarian. I've also worked in public libraries, special libraries, university libraries, any kind of library probably worked in it. And I started writing young adult novels first. I tried to be published in the YA space for about 14 years before my agent was like, why don't we try something new? And I wrote A Deadly Endeavor and it sold really fast. And so I like to say I'm an accidental mystery writer because I thought I was writing a historical romance and then all these dead bodies kept popping in. I'm so happy to be here with all of you wonderful mystery writers. It feels like such a wonderful community to be in. I'm thrilled to be here.
Welcome. Now I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your new book and your sleuth. And why don't we start with you, Jenny, because it is your debut. Is that correct? Yeah.
It is my debut. It came out March 5th. And A Deadly Endeavor is a historical mystery set in Philadelphia in 1921, starring a heartbroken socialite, Edie Shippen, who comes home from California to find that her childhood love is engaged to her twin sister. And at the same time, young women start disappearing throughout the city, and her maid actually goes missing, and her maid's brother is a city coroner, and they team up and try to track down a killer. I like to say it's kind of like if you took Alexis Rose from Schitt's Creek and Roy Kent from Ted Lasso, and you dropped them into 1921 Philly and had them catch a killer while really wanting to kiss each other. That's my book.
That's such a fabulous way to describe it. I love your book, by the way. I've read it. Oh,
thank you.
Samantha, what can you tell us about Once Upon a Murder? It's the second in your series, isn't it?
It is. The first one is A Novel Disguise, and the main heroine is Miss Tiffany Woodall, and she's a 40-year-old spinster, and in the first book, she masqueraded as her brother, so she could be a librarian, and luckily she gets to be a librarian as herself in the second, but she finds a dead body in front of her cottage in the woods, and so there's a lot of fairy tale themes. She's a librarian, so she's buying books for the young Duke, who's six. And so a lot of goody two shoes and a lot of fun things that way. And why is there a dead body in front of her house? And why does everyone think she did it?
Edie, what about you? Yours is a debut as well, is it not?
Mine is a debut. It came out about a month after Jenny's. We have the same publisher, and I'm also a school librarian, so we've become good Instagram friends. And I've learned a lot from her. And my story is actually inspired by a real life woman named Frances Glessner Lee, who's known as the mother of forensic science. She used to build these extremely detailed recreations of death scenes in miniature. And she used them to help train investigators on how to go about investigating a scene and not miss evidence. She was very concerned that guilty people were going free and innocent people were getting in trouble when they shouldn't. And so she used her miniature making skills towards that end. Ever since I heard about her, I've been completely fascinated. And I ended up creating for this story a character named Maple, who is living in post-World War II Vermont. And at the beginning of the story, her husband has just died and she's found out that she is now penniless. So she gets roped into a mystery in her town as she's trying to figure out how she's gonna, you know, move forward and make a life for herself. And she ends up discovering her first customer. She starts a custom dollhouse business because she's already got those skills. She goes to deliver her first dollhouse to her first customer, but finds him dead under very suspicious circumstances. The sheriff is not inclined to investigate the death any further. And so she builds a miniature recreation in order to walk him through all the ways he went wrong, which, as you can imagine, goes over super well with the sheriff. So I had a lot of fun using this real historical figure who I admire greatly as a as an inspiration for my fictional one.
It's kind of like when Jessica Fletcher tells the police what to do. They always embrace that wisdom.
Yeah, exactly.
Ava, what about The Mayfair Dagger? That's the first in a series?
Hopefully, yes, from your mouth to God's ears. Yeah, this is about a woman called Albertine who also finds herself the ward of her cousin. I guess her father has died unexpectedly and hasn't made any arrangement for her. And her cousin decides to sell her off to the neighbor who has 15 children and he needs a mum. So she steals the dog cart and she escapes to London and decides she's going to make it on her own in London as a detective. but she's terrible. She has no skills to speak of, and she's there with her friend, and she finds herself in the wrong place at the wrong time, and she begins to be suspected as a murderer. And one of the early reviewers has described it as Remington Steele meets Bridgerton meets Bridget Jones. So, which I just think is so, she's just, everything she does, she just messes it up, bless her.
Yeah, that's true. I never thought about the Remington Steele angle, but yeah, she does make up someone in her life.
Yes.
My next question for each of you is a two-part question. First, why historical mysteries? Why, when there's so many other kinds of mysteries, contemporary suspense, thrillers, why did you gravitate towards historical mysteries? And secondly, when you were doing your research for your particular books, what did you discover about your own book's time period that surprised you the most? And I'll open it, or I'll call on someone if no one answers.
I'll go first. I didn't tell you the time period before. So mine are in the 1780s, so Georgian England. And what really drew me to it originally is I had this idea. And it was where she finds her half-brother dead and she takes over his identity. And I thought, how could that actually work? And you just said it in a time period where it could work. Well, even in the 1780s, there's all this fake clothing, like, there's even puff, like fake penises you could put in your pants to make yourself look bigger. You could put leg stockings, arm stockings. They wear wigs. They have full face makeup. And so I thought, well, with a wig, full face makeup, dressed in men's clothes, especially if the shoulders are already padded, she could really pull off being somebody else because it's so the fashion's so extreme. And so I think the most interesting thing I learned was they actually used rat skin to make perfect eyebrows.
Wow.
Yeah. You want to try it out at home?
No.
Okay.
Well, I read historical. I was like an old lady before my time, and I grew up reading Agatha Christie, obsessed with Poirot. I mean, if I could be Jane Marple, I'll be a happy lady. I just love the creativity that you have to kind of tap into, because why don't they just pick up their mobile phone and call the police? Yeah. Writing historical really challenges you. One thing I found interesting, I think, was mine is set at the turn of the century, and there were a lot of social changes happening, but when a woman found herself wardless, even in 1904, her nearest male relative was deemed to be in charge of her. So an adult woman would, if her father died, would now have to do everything her cousin or brother said. And I found that quite intriguing. Like, what if you didn't know each other? What if you didn't like each other? That could have cause problems for people. Just found it interesting.
I can go next.
Okay, sure.
Like you, Ava, I really love reading historical mysteries, and I just historical mysteries, historical romance, historical fantasy, like that has always been my favorite thing to read. And when I came, I mean, this book kind of just like Edie appeared in my head, kind of like a freight train. And so she was fully herself. And I knew that the time period had to be sometime after World War I and the Spanish flu, but I didn't want to get too far into the 20s. So the early 20s really fit. But there's some historical events that happen in the book, including like a big solar storm that actually happened, which anchored it in 1921. And I think the most surprising thing I learned doing my research, I did a lot of research on the clothes. Edie's like really into hats and everything. The most interesting thing actually were like men's underwear in the 1920s were like one piece, like shirt, like a union suit, but even like shorts. And so like I'd never made it into the book, but I had this scene where Gilbert was getting dressed and had to think about like how he would actually get into all of his clothes. And that to me, because it feels like a time period that is not so far removed and yet very far removed, and things like underwear were totally different. My most surprising fact.
So I decided to set mine right after the end of World War II, in part because the woman I was inspired by was building her, she called them her nutshell studies of unexplained death, her little miniatures. And she was building them in the late 30s and into the 40s. And so for me, it kind of made sense to set my fictional version of her around the same time. The man she discovers dead in the story, it's inspired by one of Francis Glessner Lee's actual nutshells, which is known as Barn. And in this particular scene, there's a farmer hanging dead in a barn and from a noose. And so, one thing that I came across that was an interesting parallel for me around that time was, the Nuremberg trials and then the hanging of the people who were convicted there. So I worked that in really early on in the story. And for me, it felt like kind of this like shadow hanging over the story. And I had the characters kind of like refer back to it several times. So just reading up on that and on how that went about, how that all unfolded, how people in America were reacting, I found really interesting. I think one of the most fun things I learned, and I learned this by accident, I don't know if you guys also find fun things like this, you probably do, but I accidentally found out, I went down this little side rabbit hole by an accident about food in this time period. And I found that Kraft macaroni and cheese was becoming super popular in the US around then. And my main character, Maple, is very practical. And I thought to myself, and she's on a major budget, and I thought, wow, she would love mac and cheese if she could buy a box dinner for like 19 cents and like, you know, feed herself for 2 days. And then I ended up deciding to name her cat after that. So her cat is named Mac. He's an orange cat.
One of the other things I found fascinating in your book, Katie, was that rationing didn't end with the war. It continued on.
That's true. Yep, I found that really interesting as well. And I guess it makes sense because I was thinking about how it's, you know, it's probably had a lot to do not only with getting things to the troops overseas, but also like the transportation and infrastructure within the US, you know. So I'm sure that didn't just reinvent itself overnight. But I also found that something to be very interesting to learn about.
My next question for each of you is, you write historical mysteries, but how do you know to strike the right balance between history and mystery? Have your editors ever said you've got too much fact in your story, pull it back, focus on the mystery? Because you're appealing to, in some sense, different groups of readers, sometimes they're the same. So how do you strike that balance between incorporating history, but also giving a good mystery to a reader?
I can start if you want this time. Sure. I think the way I thought about it was I focused on building the mystery, and then I let the history support and inform the mystery, I guess. So I was primarily, Jenny said she's an accidental mystery writer. I was a very intentional mystery writer. Like, I was very much interested in writing a mystery. The nutshells, like, to me, lend themselves to, you know, creating a mystery around. It's literally like, here's this dead person. How did they get this way? And is somebody responsible? And if so, who? But I kind of always looked at it as the historical stuff really helps, I think, to build the setting. And I found it very fascinating, but everything is there to support the mystery plot for me.
I agree. I'm the same. I don't know about you ladies, but so much research into the time period and it just doesn't make it into the book. Mm. But it does inform the characters and the things they do. So mine is all about the story. The story comes first, and And there is time, especially when you're researching, all of a sudden you're down a rabbit hole about what were the heels of women's shoes made of in 1904? Oh, they were made of wood. Oh, well, she couldn't do that. So while I might just mention it in passing, you know, hours spent looking at the Victoria and Albert Museum catalogues and things like that, I think sometimes the shorter the better. I don't want to read a book that's like, well, she mentioned the wooden soles of her shoes. It still needs to flow and feel really organic, because we wouldn't talk about the soles of our shoes to each other. It, you know, we might mention like, oh, well, I can't do that because I've got my shoes on. Yes, okay, I get it. But yeah, so just making sure that the story comes first for me.
I totally agree. To me, like the Edie and Gil, my main characters in A Deadly Endeavor, they have always been the heart of the story, and there's so much research, like hours over poring over trolley maps, you know, to figure out how someone would get from A to Z in Philly, or like a map of the zoo in Philadelphia in 1921. I needed to know all of these things, but the reader didn't necessarily need to know that all the things that I knew. I mean, there are some Philadelphians who probably care very much about Philly. They're scary, intense, lovely people. And I had to make sure that I was getting so many things right, while also making sure that Edie and Gil's story was at the center. And they are the ones who propel the story and everything, both the history and the mystery, in my case, serve Edie and Gil's larger character arcs.
And I'm Samantha, because obviously you realize hearing of us knows what we look like or sound like. For me, same thing, you can't let the details get in the way of the story or the plot. But for me, I love writing an author's note, because they put in every creepy detail that I couldn't possibly find a way to get in the book. And I'm like, it's optional, but if you read it, I had so much fun writing it.
You kind of mentioned briefly before, Samantha, that your new book touches upon fairy tales, and fairy tales are not exactly the Disney version we think of today.
Oh, no. And I, you know, especially like one of the first Cinderellas is called Cunning Cinders, and her parents keep trying to get rid of her and her siblings because they don't want to take care of them anymore. And her fairy godmother gives her a string so she can find her way back home every time her parents abandon her. And then she bakes the trolls. Like, it's just, it's quite a bit darker. Just seeing what's available for children in the 1780s is kind of shocking. You're like, wow, you read that to children. And the fairy tales are actually kind of the fun part. There's always a moral. They have songs, but like, I love Miss Good, like I've used the term Goody Two Shoes a million times, but I had no idea that it, well, probably not a million. I had no idea that it was a real story about a little girl named Miss Goody Two Shoes. So like, I'd be Goody Larson, and you'd be Goody January, and Goody T-Jen, and Goody Perinovic.
What have you found to be your most valuable resource, historical resource, as you're researching and writing your books? Is there one particular source that you think, I couldn't do this series without this book, without this person, without this resource?
Google Maps and the Victoria and Albert Museum for me, because my novel is set in England. It's such an incredible resource, and it's all been cataloged, and now it's digital, which is just incredible. They have everything from so many time periods. So yeah, you really get to learn about men's underwear if you need to, and even if you don't need to.
You can go, Samantha.
I also love Victoria and Albert's, like, their fashion books. It's like a picture book for historians.
Yes, it's so good.
I have like all of them, and I don't even use those time periods just because I like to look at the pictures.
So beautiful.
Sorry, go ahead, Jenny.
Oh, I was going to say my biggest resource, I'm actually married to a 20th century historian.
Oh, wow.
So he did his PhD at Temple and he taught a history of Philly class, and he's a military historian. So when I was able to ask things like, what sort of gun would Gilbert have carried in the First World War? Eric was able to be like, oh, I got you. Because he knows this like incredible knowledge that he carries in his brain. And speaking of Temple, they have an urban archive that a lot of things are digitized about. Sorry for my dog. He's
it's okay.
Crying. Digitized materials like city photos, maps pertaining to Philadelphia history. I couldn't have done it without them.
I used a lot of resources specifically about Frances Lessner Lee for my story. Even though my character is not literally her, she's inspired. But one of the best books that I used was by Corinne May Botts, and it's a book called The Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death. And it's actually a book of amazing photography. Corinne spent a really long time photographing the 18 existing nutshells and wrote an amazing introductory essay in the book. And I was lucky enough to get to see her give an author talk at the Smithsonian a number of years ago when the nutshells were on display. They're not usually available to the public. So that book really... just really set my imagination on fire and got me really interested. And then I've gotten to go to a few places. So like some of my research has been in the form of travel. So in addition to the DC exhibit, I've been able to travel to Chicago to see the Glessner House Museum. I've traveled to New Hampshire to see the house where she built the nutshells, the estate that her family owned. I'm basically stalking a dead heiress, is what it comes down to. And then I've just found, I sort of like filled in gaps of my knowledge, like when I needed to know, like how did making phone calls work in 1946 in rural Vermont? My dad can help me with some of that thing. So Jenny has a historian in her family. My dad is a retired teacher who's also an amateur historian. So, and my grandmother used to be a phone operator. And so I could occasionally call my dad and be like, hi, I have this random question about 1946, you know? So that would be, and then just Google sometimes, honestly, could just call, you know, gave me some quick little responses if I just needed to know things like what were some slang terms. Something I really admire about Jenny's book is the way that her characters use such authentic sounding language from the time period. And that can be hard to do. Like, I think the farther back you're writing, probably the harder that is to pull off. So that, you know, I think that's a good thing to learn about too.
You also
what I'm hearing is my family needs to step up because we don't know nothing.
I was going to jump in about the slang, Katie. I think there's so many parallels between the 1920s slang and the way kids tend to talk right now. And so like being around young people all the time, I'm like, all right, how can I like swap in like copacetic for Riz, you know, like all this stuff, like the kids
no
are
cat.
Saying that kind of. Exactly. Like they sound, yeah.
Yeah, I'm bra now. I've not been mom in years.
Me too.
But you guys are making me a little curious. I don't want to say jealous because I'm going to sound like I'm mad at my main character, but Maple is not a fashionista at all. So listening to you guys talk about it, it makes me like very interested to go look at the Victoria and Albert website and everything now.
Albertine's broke. She's got one dress. She's not there. Like, talk about things that didn't make it in. Albertine spent all her money on the one dress to look fancy. That's it. That's all she's got.
Maple's wearing around her dead brother's old pea coat for much of my novel. So she's not that. So fashion is one area I did not do a ton of research about.
Did Maple get her love of dollhouses from you? Is that something you gave her character?
Well, okay. I don't, this might be a slightly disappointing answer, but not really. Someone asked me at my book launch event the other week if if I too enjoy making dollhouses, and I do not. I gave the analogy of I very much enjoy reading stories about people who climb Mount Everest. That's like a weird subgenre of things that fascinate me. I would never in a million years want to do it myself. Little less dramatic with dollhouse making. I have no interest in crafting super detailed dollhouses. I would much rather write about Maple doing it.
Let's talk a little bit about your writing process when you approach your books, because you are writing mysteries. So my guess is that you would need to know how to structure the plot so that you can insert clues, you can insert red herrings, you can introduce possible suspects. But I've been surprised some authors, when they're writing mysteries, just say, no, I just start writing and hope it all comes together in the end. So is there a particular path you take when you're writing your books?
Gosh, I'm that writer. I sit down, the characters come to me. I knew that Albertine was a foolish person. And I would say, like, nowadays, maybe she's very impulsive. She's very reckless, maybe a little ADHD. She just does things and then says, oh, yeah, that didn't work out the way that I thought that was going to work out. And I knew that I really wanted Spencer to have some reason to be in her vicinity, investigating her. And I'm what you've probably heard the term, I'm a pantser. So I sit down, I give myself 1,000 words every day. And quite often I am just as surprised as everyone else, because I sit down and we might have been going in one direction when I ended yesterday, but today the characters decide they're going in a completely different direction and I just go with it.
Have you had to write yourself out of a corner then that you put yourself into?
I think in the editing process, there are some things that were just funny scenes that happened or don't really make any sense or don't drive the plot forward. So I think in the writing process, I just let myself go for it. And then in the editing process, I'm far more diligent, like, well, here is actually where she needs to maybe begin to investigate, or hit the plot points that we need to. So the writing's the fun, the editing's like, no, I let you do what you like. Now we're going to sit down and do what I tell you to do.
One thing I do, this is Samantha, is I am a plotter, but I just give an outline. I don't choose the murderer till the end.
Really?
And for me, what it does is it means any of the characters could be the murderer. And for me, it keeps it open till the very end. And then I decide who the murderer really is. And sometimes I have to go out a few little red herrings. But for me, that keeps it really exciting, because I'm like, well, they could have done it. They have a really good reason. They were there. They have this, you know, and it's fun for me as a writer to be like, well, who did it? As Stephen King said, the first draft is just telling yourself the story. And that's how I tell myself the story.
I love that. That keeps it really interesting. Could be anybody, even to the author.
That's amazing. I am a total outliner, a total plotter. But for A Deadly Endeavor in particular, it went through a lot of versions of like what it was. When it went on submission, there was actually like ghost and necromancy involved on top of the kissing and the murder. And so when we sold it, with the caveat that it was going to be a historical mystery now, I had to actually go back in and figure out, like, how do I put in a red herring? How do I make it a mystery? Which was really difficult. And I'm a person who loves revising. I think, like, the opposite of you, Ava, like, revising to me is where the magic happens and where a whole book comes together. I'm a very lean drafter. I have, like, a 40-page outline that goes to, like, a 50,000-word manuscript, and then it grows from there. I'm writing the sequel to A Deadly Endeavor right now, and it is a completely different process because I know I'm writing a mystery this time. And I actually got to plan for the mystery beats. And it's been really fun to like weave all that stuff in from the beginning. And I'm hoping it'll mean a little less work, but the mystery as we go into revisions.
I fall somewhere in the middle, I think, on the plotter versus pantser spectrum, where I like to have an outline. I like to have a little bit of a roadmap or a sense of like kind of like the big idea of the story and where it might be headed. I did totally change the ending of Death in the Details. I also changed a bunch of stuff in the middle, and I probably rewrote chapter one 17 times. But for me, part of the fun is just discovering what happens along the way. There is a character in this story who has a pet dachshund. He's like a chubby dachshund. And I did not know there was going to be an adorable, lovable, chubby dachshund in this story. Frank just wandered in. Actually, what happened was Maple was getting ready to go out to the store. And all of a sudden, as I'm typing, she's putting some crust of bread into her pocket. And I was like, oh, why are you doing that? And then, I don't know, it's just so funny. It's like sometimes, like you were saying, Ava, sometimes they take over. So sometimes I kind of like follow the characters down the little path. And then sometimes I have to like nudge them back and say, no. And in this chapter, I need you to be at the diner. So like, I need to get you there.
You can't be chasing this dog around for the whole chapter, honey. No. You have to come back to the diner. My dog took over as well. I have a dog called Fake Fancy. And I had a whole chapter where Spencer and Albertine, they go to a dog catcher. And this was one of the interesting facts that I found and discovered, and was like, there were dog catchers? Okay. What would that look like? And he would steal people's dogs and then he would sell them back to him. That was his job. Ooh. And so they broke into the dog catcher's shop and released all of the dogs, but that didn't make it into the book.
Oh, that's a fun little like side detail.
Yeah.
Jenny has a dog in her book too.
I do. Aphrodite is a pug, and I thought Edie just needed this ridiculous little creature to like put big bows on and just be her best friend. She's been really isolated for a long time. And Aphrodite seemed to be like the perfect vehicle for that sort of levity.
How great of a name is Aphrodite for a pug? I love it.
It is. My next question for each of you is, for some of you, this is your debut book. Others have been writing for a while. What have you learned about publishing, about writing books? What knowledge do you now have that you wish you could go back to when you were first starting out as a writer and say, this is what you need to know?
I mean, here we sit and talk for another hour. I mean, for me, because I was published in Australia, the market is really different in America. So that was... some things my editor queried that seemed really obvious to me. And she would say, I don't even understand what this word is. I don't understand why someone would do this. And so there was some cultural things that Americans just don't say or do. But I think for me, the biggest thing is, do you want to be published? If so, you need to study the art of, you know, these plot points. Like I think it was maybe you, Katie, that mentioned you'd written manuscripts, but you didn't know that they had to do certain things. So I would write and just kind of write, because that's, you know, what I thought writers did. I didn't realize that you sit down and you make your word count and you keep this story arc in mind, and there are beats and plot points and things that readers expect to find in their mystery stories. That was maybe the biggest learning.
One thing that helped me with that was I discovered a book called Save the Cat Writes a Novel.
Hey, you Americans love Save the Cat. That's how I ended up with Fake Fancy.
Well, and it does just what you're talking about with beats, like it kind of like clues you into how the person that wrote it was originally conceived as a resource for screenwriters, and then they made a specific version of it targeted towards novelists. And it does a great job of walking you through the beats that we as humans are sort of like hardwired to expect and at roughly at what point in the story. Even to the point that I would tell my husband about it, who's not a fiction writer, but now when we're watching a movie, he'll be like, he'll like call out which story beat that
it's
we're
the Dark
at.
Night of the Soul.
Yeah, that's what he'll do. He'll be like, wait, is this Dark Night of the Soul? And I'll be like, maybe, well, hold on, let's see. And so that book was really helpful in terms of, I actually came upon it when I was in the process of revising a manuscript. So it can be really helpful in planning what you're going to do, but I also found it really helpful in posing. It didn't feel limiting to me. It felt liberating because I was like, oh, it helped me figure out like how to rearrange some things so that like a certain, you know, thing happened at the 25% mark instead of the 40% mark of the story. And then Story Genius is another book that I found really helpful. That is, again, it's kind of about the psychology, like the brain science behind storytelling. So those two that you got me thinking about those, Ava, I discovered those while I was revising Death in the Details, and those were great. I also just want to add, I think the main thing that has delighted me about the publishing journey is that I've just met so many kind, amazing, generous people along the way, you know. And you always hear, and I'm sure this is true in a lot of ways, you always hear that publishing is a very can be a very harsh business. I just feel so lucky to have landed with this amazing agent who's so supportive. I've had so many writers offer me like guidance and generous advice and stuff along the way. I've made Instagram friends with my narrator for my audiobook and my cover artist and other authors. So that's just been like finding this nice community has just been such a delight.
For me, I feel like I'm the old person on the block today. I've gone through, I've published with 6 different publishers. I used to think once you get published, you're like done and everything's going to be so rosy and perfect. And that
let the money roll
my experience. Okay. So I will have to say is that getting published is hard. Staying published is also really hard. And that's something to keep in mind because I did not realize that going in. But I always wanted to be an author since I was a little kid. So I remember meeting Shannon Hell probably 20 years ago, and she had she had laminated together all these rejection letters, and back when they printed things, and she was like, I got all these rejections, but now I'm, you know, I have, you know, all these books. And I thought, I don't mind rejections, but I too have lots of, I can't imagine how long my line would be, my roll of rejections would be now. And I would have to say that if you're going to write because you love it, because there's no guarantee it will ever get published. And if it gets published, there's no guarantee that you're going to be a bestseller. So just love it, because it brings you joy, it sparks joy into you, and just keep trying.
I think I have to echo everything that everyone has said here. And I think for me, the biggest thing that I've learned in like getting that debut novel published is the market is what it is, and where things end up on a bookshelf dictate what is going to be bought. When I finished the first draft of A Deadly Endeavor and I sent it to my agent, and she's like, what genre do you think this is? And I was like, historical romance with paranormal like murder mystery. And she's like, Jenny, that's not a genre. Like, where is that gonna go? And I was like, oh. And then like, that's a really real concern. You know, that's a really real thing. Like, there's only so many shelves in a bookstore. There's only so many places a book can go. And so while there are places to push the envelope within genre, it is okay to stick firmly in one place and get your foot in the door. Another thing I think too is that I've been trying to do this for a really, really long time, and I've seen so many friends make it, and so many other incredibly talented friends just have not gotten their yeses yet. And I think just being kind to the people around you and being a genuine and supportive member of your community goes a really long way. I mean, this publishing world is small, and people remember. So give them something good to remember about you. And, you know, just remember that the person you're helping today, you might need their help later on, or, you know, they might sell and become like this like ginormous bestseller, and you're going to be so proud of them, and you want to be like so proud of them. So just be kind is really, I think, the biggest thing. Be kind.
Speaking to this, Jenny, you talk about knowing the market. You have a degree in medieval studies.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about writing a historical mystery set in the Middle Ages, or were people telling you, no, Ellis Peters was the only one that could do that, so forget it?
I actually wrote historical, fa I wrote, I think, four historical fantasy manuscripts set in the late medieval, early modern period. Actually, my degree focused on French fairy tales, like 14th century fairy tales. And so everything I wrote, those four manuscripts, were pulled from the tradition of early French romance. It's very esoteric very quickly. But they were also young adult manuscripts set in like historical Alsace and Germany. And I loved writing them. And I hope maybe one day they'll find a home. I say never say never. And I think it would be super fun to write a 14th century mystery one day. A totally different challenge in the 1920s in a lot of ways. It'd be super fun. So never say never.
Let's change gears a little bit. Some of you have talked about authors that you read and loved, but let's look at you as a reader. Who are some of the authors and books that have been important to you, that have inspired you to write historical mysteries? If someone were to come up to you, a reader, and say, who should I read? Who is good in historical mysteries? Outside of the authors that are here today, who would you tell them that they need to read?
I love Rice Bowen. I love Sherry Thomas, Deanna Rayburn. I also really like my friend Bethany or B.R. Myers. She's got another book coming out.
God, I love her.
She's fabulous.
She's your friend. Oh, please tell her that you were on this podcast and I got excited when you
I know.
So
and
good.
I never met her. She lives in Canada, but we were publisher sisters or editor sisters. So
she's wonderful.
She's fabulous. So, and there's so many more because I'm a librarian. There's a million. Those are my favorites.
I want to echo Deanna Rayburn and Sherry Thomas. I really love Nikesa Afia. Her Dead Dead Girls and Harlem Renaissance series is just so good. I also really love Kate Kavari's Botanist Guide mysteries. They are just delightful. I love anything that has like kind of this intersection of historical mystery and historical romance, and I think she really nails it. Those are my four.
I loved her too.
She's great.
I second everything they've said. Deanna Rayburn is a queen. I think I like a little bit of humor. She's a very soft touch with that, which I can't do. I'm more of a cosh over the head, like, hey, I'm being funny kind of writer. So I really appreciate that about hers. And Sherry Thomas's Lady Sherlock series is phenomenal. Phenomenal. Talk about deeply researched. I mean, they are really very incredible novels.
Well, I would like to thank you all because my TBR list, I'm like keeping a little list over here as you guys are all, not just your books, but also now the books you're talking about. Probably my favorite historical mystery series is the Maisie Dobbs series by Jacqueline Winspear, which I just adore them. I cannot like fangirl hard enough. To the extent that I named my cat Maisie after Maisie Dobbs. and the very last book in that series is coming out in early June, which I have extremely mixed feelings about. And then another series I like a lot is Maureen Johnson writes a young adult series about a character named Stevie Bell. And it's not technically entirely historical, but it's about the Truly Devious series. The first book is called Truly Devious. And the main character is a teenager who gets accepted to this special residential school where you get to pursue your passion project. And hers is investigating a case that happened at the school that was never solved. And so the first three books bounce back and forth between the present day narrative with Stevie the sleuth and a historical narrative of the story of what really happened. So I just enjoy the heck out of those books too.
Oh, now you reminded me I have to add one. Jennifer Donnelly's A Northern Light, which is a young, it's so good. It's a YA mystery set in a resort in upstate New York. And it's based on a true story. And that was, I mean, just a masterclass. Like, it is so beautiful.
I love that one too. And I thought of a couple more too. I got to know Maggie Winters this year, and she's fabulous. And I love both of her books. And I feel like Amelia Peabody is kind of like the mother of our genre.
Yeah.
Or like kind of the in between. We've got Agatha Christie, who's very like, but when you add romance to it, that's really for me Amelia Peabody. And I have to love her because my mom had all of her books on tape, and we listened to them on every vacation. Uh-huh. I'm showing how old I am.
My next question you can answer if you'd like, but if not, I understand because some authors are cautious about this. Can you tell us what we can expect next from you? We have books.
I've just sold another manuscript that is not.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. This was when you said before, Jenny, never say never. Never say never, because this I thought was dead. But I resurrected them. It's a gothic mystery about identical twin sisters who get pulled from England into the Gilded Age of New York, and it's about madness and there's asylums, and it's very dark and gothic and juicy. So that's next from me.
Gothics have become hot again. They go in cycles, but
yes, they were dead, and I love, so my like gothics I just absolutely adore. And I wrote this many years ago, and it was hard to write. I actually wrote it at the exact same time as the Mayfair Dagger, because it was so dark and gloomy, it would leave me feeling really depressed. So I would say, if you do 1,000 words of this manuscript, it's called The Mirror Sisters, you can write The Mayfair Dagger. So I would write these, slog through the 1,000 words of the gloomy Mirror Sisters, and then I would counteract that by writing the light and fun Albertine.
And we don't want to steer off any potential readers. When you say gloomy, you mean atmospheric.
Atmospheric. Yes, thank you so much. It's not gloomy. It's atmospheric. No humor, which is, you know, hard for me because the Mayfair Dagger is very funny.
Anyone else want to share?
I can go next. I am actually, it's due on Wednesday, May 1st, is the sequel to A Deadly Endeavor, another Edie and Gil adventure. I don't think we've revealed the title yet, but I can tell you that it deals with poison and a silent film star and a movie studio that actually existed in the early 1920s, right outside of Philadelphia. And there's lots more Edie and Gil fun. There's a monkey involved this time. Gil has to act in a silent film, and he's miserable the whole entire time. And Edie gets to be start her life as a lady detective. And it is so fun, and I cannot wait to get to share all the things about it.
Gil kind of has a reputation as being a ladies, the ladies like him, let's say.
Yes. And he doesn't understand why.
I guess I'll go next. I have a book coming out May 13th under Samantha Hastings, and it's by Any Other Name. And it's kind of Jane Austen meets COVID, but which is or my other tagline that they hated was a rom-com about grief and depression. The publisher didn't like either of those, frankly, but it's very much inspired by Jane Austen's life. She had a sibling that was adopted by a wealthy relative and ended up providing her and her mother and her sister housing later because he was wealthy and they were broke. And then I have a Harlequin coming out this summer, August 22nd, an accidental courtship with the Earl. And that's another fun one. So I'm excited. I've got fun things coming up.
Amy?
That's great. Congrats, everybody. I am very cautiously optimistic about a sequel for Death in the Details. So if everybody could put, you know, good vibes into the universe for me, I would appreciate it.
Call your local library to buy copies. Go to your local bookstore and order them. Well, I do have a totally unrelated question for you, Katie, because I read something about you and this question came to me. I will admit that I have bought Lipton tea bags and I enjoy Lipton tea. Can we ever be friends?
Yes.
Okay.
I think you're referring to my
tea snobbishness.
My joke that I'm a tea snob, but otherwise a very nice person. I'll drink Lipton in a pinch.
Okay.
But I would never try to micromanage anyone else's tea preferences.
I put Americans only drink coffee. I didn't know you drank tea.
Yeah, some of us do.
I'm a subset of the stereotypical American population. It is a coffee drinker's world over here, but you know, some of us are persevering as tea drinkers.
Before we run out of time, can you tell us a little bit about how readers can find out more about you and your books? Are you on social media? And remind us once again what your new book is, the title, and where we can find it. Ava, why don't we start with
my book? Yeah, my book is The Mayfair Dagger, and it was released 2 days ago, actually, so it was all very new. Any readers can find me on Instagram or my website. I get emails, and honestly, when people email me about my books, it is just such a joy. So my website is www.avajanuary.net.au.
Katie?
I have a website that is kdtjin.com, and you can also find me on Instagram at ktwrites, K-T-E-A.
Samantha?
So my website is samanthahastings.com, but my book is Once Upon a Murder by Samantha Larson. So, and then I'm on Instagram and Facebook at Samantha Hastings author, and then I'm on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it as Hastings Samantha, and I love getting to know readers. So,
Jenny,
I forgot to say my title. Mine is Death in the Details.
Sure.
So you can find me on Instagram and pretty much everywhere else under J Adams Writes. And my website is jenny-adams.com because there are a lot of Jenny Adamses in the world, and it was hard to pin down that domain name. And my book is A Deadly Endeavor. It came out March 5th.
I can't believe how quickly an hour has flown by. The Poison Pen has been very fortunate to have with us four incredibly talented and interesting authors: Ava, Katie, Samantha, and Jenny. If you're a historical fiction fan, historical mystery fan, or like a little bit of romance with your history, their new books will definitely fill the bill. I'd like to thank all four authors for joining us today and chatting about their books. And for those of you tuning in, thank you for joining another episode of Author Chats at the Poison Pen.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.